stalemate. And also, I thought that the stalemate thing in chess was a bit of, was bullshit. That if I have if I have you cornered, I mean stalemate when the enemy has no moves. If I have you cornered,
yeah,
and then it just and you have no moves. For to me, this shouldn't be a stalemate. This should be a win.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Game Engineering Podcast. Today, I am joined by Oriol Kosp, the creator of the Ouroboros King, a unique roguelike game blending traditional chess and innovative mechanics. We delve into two main topics, project management and game design. In the first part, Oriol talks about managing the game projects efficiently and offers a lot of valuable advice for aspiring game developers. And note that he just made his first game in 12 months, which is quite fast by today's standards. And in the second half, we explore the game's design, how he made chess more fun and engaging, how he added new chess pieces with new movesets and mechanics, all that. I hope you enjoy the show. Maybe let's do it like this. I will tell you what the Ouroboros King is about, and you'll tell me whether this is an apt description.
Okay.
Okay. So, Ouroboros King is a roguelike game inspired by chess and chess mechanics. You have to follow a path, like in a Slay the Spire kind of thing. So this is the roguelike element. So you're following a path, encountering different battles or ways to upgrade your stuff. And the battles are basically the battleground for the encounters is chessboard. And you don't fully battle the whole chess match. You have a couple of pieces, and there's a lot of extensions to chess, which I had no idea that you can do it before I met the Ouroboros King. Like, it didn't have not crossed my mind. Is this a proper description or not?
Yeah, I think so. So I think what you mean by extensions to chess, you mean like there's lots of new pieces with new mechanics, yes, and new ideas that are not present in base chess.
Yes.
There's, I think, a whole community of people and games called fairy chess. So it's okay. Chess with fairy pieces, and these fairy pieces are chess pieces with extra abilities, different movesets. On Wikipedia, there's tons of examples of different pieces. I did steal some of those, but not all of them. And I think one of the members of my Discord channel said that this is sort of like chess, but also sort of like Magic the Gathering, where there's some weird combos. In chess, there's not that many synergies. Like, you can do a battery and put two rooks one in front of the other, and that's very powerful, and there's some synergy there. But in the Ouroboros King, there's much more powerful synergies. And so it has the both elements. You can just play straight up tactically and beat up your opponent by controlling the most of the squares and not allowing them to have good moves. But you can also make some really powerful combinations that can outright win you the game in some situations and put you in a very good position in some others.
Yeah. And you made this game in 1 year, which is, to me, quite astounding. Is that correct?
I made it in 1 year, and then I released it, and then I spent about 6 months making some improvements that included localization, controller support, some bug fixing. The game in its release state had more bugs than I would have loved to release with. I added some extra content in the form of new pieces, and I also released it for mobile.
Yeah. Let's do it maybe like this. We'll first focus on the project management, right? And then we'll move into a little bit more game design,
okay,
and design parts. So first of all, you mentioned beforehand to me that you don't have background in game development you have a background, obviously, enough to make a game. It's more that you started more and worked before as a data scientist, right?
Yep. So if you want, I can give a brief introduction about my background, and so we may work from
there.
Sure. So I'm 32 now. So I finished university about 10 years ago. I studied mathematics and civil engineering. There's a double degree program here in Barcelona. And after that, I worked as a data scientist, mostly in consulting, but I also did some years in a product company. So my background is data science. I quit my job about 3 or 4 months ago. So until very recently, I was still working as a data scientist. This gave me a lot of, let's say, programming background. So I've been professionally coding for 10 years, maybe 8 before starting the Ouroboros, working on the Ouroboros King. And then I started learning Unity on, I think it was August 2021. And yeah, from there, I did a couple of small projects. And on February 2022, I started working on the Ouroboros King. And then it took a year working. I was working part-time and doing this on my free time. I also have a daughter, so that took a bit of time. But yeah, I started, and when I started, I thought that maybe this would take 6 months or so. But usually one tends to be very optimistic when starting a project. And also as at the end, I was like, okay, I think this looks like a complete game. I could go on adding new features, but I think this looks like a complete game, so it's time to release. And
so how did you scope the project, and how did you think of the deadline?
I just thought, so a year is a very like whole round number, so I said I'll spend a year on it. It felt like a year should be enough. If obviously, while you're working on it, you adjust and you correct your estimates. And if you're doing something and you feel like there's no way you're going to finish it, you have to make a decision. My point is, you have to be aware that there is a decision to be made. You either extend your scope, and you consciously do so. You choose, okay, I was planning to do this in a year, and I will take 1 year and 3 months, or 1 year and a half, or 2 years. But you decide, you are consciously and you're aware that you're making this decision. Or you say, okay, we'll cut it here, and this is what will be. So for example, for the Ouroboros, I had a couple more ideas of things. For instance, you play chess matches, and the win condition is that you kill the enemy king. You capture. I always hated this checkmate thing. I feel like when playing in the board, I never play like serious chess. So, but playing with friends, I like to take the enemy king. It feels better to me than a checkmate. That's it. So you win by taking the enemy king. And so I thought maybe there we can have some other alternative win conditions, like control these squares or move your king to this safe spot at the other side of the board while you are outnumbered. So I thought about, and this didn't make it into the game because I had to make this decision. Do I spend more time working on this or do I finish the project? I will also say that until a month before the game, or maybe until 2 weeks before the game, I didn't know if the game was going to be successful or not, because I had gathered some wishlists, but really small number. And when I had a demo that I was very confident in, I sent it to streamers. This was sort of planned. For marketing stuff, I recommend Chris Zukowski of How to Market a Game. But in one of his blog posts, he suggested that you contact streamers 2 or 3 weeks before your Steam Next Fest event, where you participate. And so my Steam Next Fest event was in February, and I contacted streamers at the end of January. So until streamers played my game, I didn't have almost any wish lists. And I was like, okay, I spent some time working on this game. This is something that I'm proud of. I'm proud of this game. This is not shovelware. So we'll put it into Steam and see how the market receives it. And if I had the confidence that this would be a success commercially, let's say, maybe I could have spent more time, and I did after lunch. But yeah, at some point you have to decide to cut scope and say, I'm happy. I think when it's something that you feel like is a complete game, you're proud of your game, you can cut scope there.
You make it sound so easy, but I think Game Dev Graveyard is full of not finished projects that are too, like, scope went just out of the window, and people just either by being tired of making this game or due to financial reasons or whatever, they just stopped right at some point. So this is why I'm so excited to talk about the project management with you, because you have such a clear idea of how to set up your goal, deliver, execute on it, deliver, and then move on. At least that's how I perceive it.
Okay. So here I would say that there's lots of hobbyists in this industry, and I started as a hobbyist. And I now since quit my job and I'm working on a new project, and this is my full-time job now. And so I'm, if the Ouroboros King wasn't commercially successful, it was fine for me. I had another job, but now my next game has to be commercially successful. Well, maybe how I'm treating this is my income from the Ouroboros King is like my company funds, and this can pay me about 2 years of salary. Yeah. So I have 2 years to make at least a game that kicks the ball further, and then I'll have X time to make another game that works. But there's lots of hobbyists and there's lots of people that are not treating this like a job, and they're like, okay, I want to make this. This is my dream game. And when they, and also, if I've done lots of software projects, lots of people going into games have not done lots of software projects, and they don't know how to scope, they don't know how long it takes. So this is also either having worked in software previously or doing lots of games will help you develop the skills to more or less scope everything. And a good rule of thumb is take the time you estimate to complete something, multiply it by two, and then that's your deadline.
How did you scope? Because you mentioned the Ouroboros King was supposed to take 6 months, but it took a year, which is exactly twice the time you estimated, right?
Yeah, but so, and there's also when you have a deadline, you sort of adjust to that deadline. if you're close to it, you start, and you want to meet the deadline, you start cutting scope. So if I didn't have that deadline, so it's not like, oh, I have such a clear mind that I perfectly predicted that it was double. No. It's like, we're getting close to the deadline. I have to finish the game. So I stop adding more content, and 2 or 3 months before meeting the deadline, you have to stop adding more content, and you have to start making it look like a finished product. So then is when you start to polish and have everything in order.
How did the production look like? Because sometimes a lot of games start with the pre-production part, when they pretty much disregard any kind of visual parts. They just iterate on how different game design mechanics could look like and things like that. And then there's the production part, where you print out pretty much like content, you add this into the games, you make levels, you make animations, you make models and things like that, because you know what is the game supposed to be about. How did it look like for your
yeah
game?
So for me, one of the most important questions going into this game was, will I be able to make a decent chess engine? Because that's not an easy task. I think the AI for the Ouroboros King is fine. It beats me if I'm distracted or if I'm not 100% invested in the game. And if I'm not a very good chess player, but I'd say a decent chess player. For reference, maybe I was like 1400 in Elo in chess.com or something like, or some of these apps. So I think this is like the average Elo of a player that plays rated games. And this is half the Elo of Magnus Carlsen, for instance. So I'm not super good. I have a couple of friends that are good, and they're like rated 2100, more or less. So I would say that is a very good level for 1400. I'd say it's, I think, a bit above the average player of chess.com, for instance, but not a lot higher. So I made an engine. So one of my initial hypotheses going into this game was, can I make an engine that is decent to play against? And I think I succeeded, but I spent maybe the first month and a half, or maybe I spent 1 month making a basic chess engine, not engine in, as in the AI, but as a game that lets you play chess in Unity. And then after I had that, I started working on the engine, and I spent, I don't know if it was 2 months or 1 month, working on making a chess engine. And I had to test that hypothesis, because without that, there is no game.
Yeah.
Like, you cannot have play chess versus random moves, because it's so easy. This was for me the key thing, that if I had it, I could make a chess game, and if I didn't, there was no hope. And in the end, it worked out, but I had some doubts for some time. And also, so answering your question, first, testing my hypothesis that of, can I make this game? And here the question is, can I make a chess engine that is decent and sort of fun to play against? And so once I answered that question, I made like a bare bones prototype of the game with not very good graphics. And from there, I kept adding elements. So in the game, there's the chess battles. So I made that, and I had chess battles with some new pieces, and I had a way to, not every, so I don't have a specific code for each piece. I generally have a framework, and then and each piece is just some new data in an Excel file. And so it's, adding content is sort of cheap, unless the content has very unique behavior, because if it has unique behavior, I need to add more code. But so I had this framework in place, and I created some pieces. And then I had the battle with some the basic chess pieces, and then some new ones. From there, I need to make this Slay the Spire-esque map. So I made the map, all with bad graphics at this point. Then I added, I need to be able to recruit new pieces for your army. So I made the recruit. I also need to upgrade some pieces. So I made the upgrade screen. And I kept adding elements. So I sort of had a playable game at all points, and I kept adding elements to it. Since very early, I think I put it on each, but it was not a very good game at the start, I would say. I don't want to trick anyone. It was not a very good game. And at some point, we can talk about this, which is game design later, but at some point I realized that I needed to change my philosophy approaching how pieces were made. But yeah, so it's what you said, basically. So start with the mechanics, keep adding pieces to it until you have most of the mechanics, and then add some polish on top of it.
Yeah, but also let's highlight that you let your game tell you what it is lacking, right? For example, you mentioned that you realized that you need to recruit your new pieces, right? You felt that this is the need. You sounded like it's when you realized this in game, kind of, that this would...
Not what... really. I had in mind, so having played, I was in... I sort of modeled my game around this, around Slay the Spire. And it's not exactly one-to-one, but there's, in Slay the Spire, you add new cards to your deck, so I add new pieces. In Slay the Spire, you have relics that affect everything around your gameplay. I have relics that affect everything in your gameplay. You upgrade cards, you can upgrade your pieces. So there's lots of parallels, and from the start, I had some ideas. There's things that are in Slay the Spire that are not in the Ouroboros King. For instance, in Slay the Spire, there's events where lots of weird things can happen. So you can sort of make bets and win, sometimes lose. This isn't in the Ouroboros King. And it's because I cut it from scope. I was like, there's no time for events. Events look like something very time consuming where you have to program 15 different things. And I don't want to do that. Not like I would do that if I had infinite time, but I want to finish this game in a year, more or less. And so that goes out. I don't think it's a high value feature of the game. So it goes out. And so there's no events.
Okay. And so you had a vision beforehand, how you want the game to look like. And then you had this part of pre-production where you started from the engine, and then you worked on different features that you wanted to see in the game. And then you had this production part where you actually tried to make it look nicer and then play nicer and realize, like, iterate on the game design itself. Is that right?
Yep. Okay. Yep.
What tools have you used for managing the, like, making sure you're on track and things like that.
Okay, so I for productivity tools, I mainly use a Google Sheets. I have a Google for every project I do. I have a Google Sheets with lots of tabs where I will just throw ideas if I have an idea. So ideas for new pieces, ideas for relics, and there I also have a tab with sort of all the tasks that need to be done. So you need to make a chess game in a chess board that can play chess in Unity. You need to make an AI. You need to make this map. You need to make the recruiting screen use, and so on. But then I'll have more fine grain details on a Trello board where I put. So when I start working on one of these big tasks, I break it into smaller tasks and then I put that into a Trello board. I think you can use an Excel file and you can use Notepad if you want, like whatever productivity tool. Mm-hmm. You can use a notebook, whatever productivity tool works for you, But I think it's important that when you sit to work on your game, or if you're on a standing desk when you go to work on your game, it's important that you know what you're doing, that you're not like, what can I do today? I think this, like knowing what you're going to work on, makes you more productive and gives you a direction, a clear direction from the start. And yeah, also, so for scoping, it's very useful to know which tasks need to be done. So if someone asks you how long will this take, and you don't break it down into smaller tasks, it's very, very difficult to give an estimate. But when you break it down into smaller tasks, you can say, okay, so making the map may take about a week or may take about a month, I don't know, depending on how complex you want to make it. But breaking things into smaller tasks helps a lot with estimates. You will always be wrong. Everyone is wrong. I remember I read this book called Thinking Fast and Slow about it's a classic from Daniel Kahneman. And I think it was in the book that he said, even us that we are trained psychologists, that we study human biases. We thought this book would be written in, I don't know, 1 year and it took five. So everyone is, so nobody gets the estimates perfect, but I think it can help a lot. And if you're not very delusional, you can try to scope, like when doing this and trying to scope a game, you can realize if this is something that you can do or if you can't. And if there's some questions like you may have, like I had, can I make this question, like can I make a decent chess engine? Try to answer those questions in the first stages of the project, not at the end. Imagine I had built the whole, I left the engine for the end and the end was like, okay, I cannot make this work.
Yeah. The ordering definitely matters, right? Like you have to do the core work that decides on the fate of your project first. It's definitely the thing. And have you added some things that you did not think about in the first place during the development, or you tried to stick to all the things that you've planned?
I did add some things. Based on player suggestions after the game. For instance, I added a practice mode and an endless mode, which were not scoped for in the beginning. But when the game came out, so developing this game was asking, I from the start, I said, I want to develop this in the open and try to build a community around it so I can have player feedback at all times. But almost nobody was interested in it. And with games, what happened to me, and I think happens a lot, is that when some streamer picks your game up, then they can play it. But streamers will pick your game up when it looks good and when it has a lot of content, not when you have a badly done prototype and you put it on itch and that's all. Maybe if your game is a killer, if you're making Vampire Survivors or whatever, maybe then it can be picked up early or something, but not in my case. And so I didn't have any feedback during development, but when I was about to release, I got a ton of feedback. And I think some players asked for an endless mode after you beat the final boss. And I thought that was an interesting idea and I added it. And some players really, really liked it. And to win the game, you have to play like 15 or 16 chess battles. And I have had players play about 1,000 battles after that, which absolutely blows my mind. Even my brother told me the other day that he maybe played 100 or 200 battles in Infinity Mode, which so this tells me that, okay, there's some people really liking that game and it was a good idea to add Infinity Mode. And I also added Practice Mode, where you can set up a chess game with these pieces and play a game. And one thing that I really like about this is that this enables local multiplayer, which I think is... So I didn't have time to, or the expertise to make a multiplayer game. I don't know how to do it. Well, maybe with a turn-based one, I could do it. I've set up servers in the past and I could do an easy API, but I wouldn't know how to make a real-time multiplayer game. But it was clearly, making a multiplayer in this game was clearly not in the scope, but making practice mode and having it be able to serve as a local multiplayer game was also a good bonus. So I added that. And also other things that I have added that I weren't initially in the scope is specific things. So pieces that I didn't think of at first, and then there was a suggestion, or maybe some I came up with during development. There were lots of instances of that. So I would say, generally speaking, you have to have a clear vision. You can always add things to that vision, but also being very mindful about the scope creep. And this is the big things, the structure of your project. But then the small things, you can add lots of small things of specific. If you're making a card game, you can always add some new mechanics during development, and this shouldn't derail your project.
Yeah. I really like this approach of yours for the clear vision and not to be distracted in different kinds of ways. Can you tell me more about the release process? You mentioned that you sent your game to streamers, but before that, how did you conceptualize the release process? And you have a demo that is free, right?
Yep.
So how did the work on the timeline? When did you do what?
Okay, so I tried to have a demo as soon as possible, but at the start it was a bad demo, and so I don't know if I would do things the same way. But how I did it for, I maybe can tell you how I did it for the Ouroboros King, and then I can tell you my strategy for next game and okay. What are the differences. So when I had a quite early prototype, I put the demo on each. It was a complete game. It had a menu and it had a map, but maybe I think you could just recruit new pieces or recruit and upgrade pieces. And that's, so there were no relics and there were like, I don't know, four or five. So it was the basic pieces and very little extra. I think it was just one extra piece. And then it was like not upgrades, but downgrades, let's say. So instead of buying a bishop, you could buy a small bishop that only moved three squares or something like this. And this is what I first released. The base game, crap graphics, bad graphics, with just the basic pieces and one extra one. And if someone and has played, the other one was the Viking and Berserker. And this was maybe after 4 or 5 months of working on my game. Keep in mind, I think that if I had to do this now, I would have it done in a month. But so it was my beginnings. I was starting, so it took some time. And I released that. Almost nobody played it. I had some feedback, and somebody told me that maybe it was better. So some of the philosophy of the start was that you had bad pieces and you upgraded them into the regular chess pieces.
Okay.
And so someone told me that this was a bad idea and that maybe I should have like chess pieces and then upgrade them into better pieces. And this is what I ended up doing at the end. Yeah. And it was way better. So I don't remember who said this, but thank you very much. I think it was some random comment in itch.io. So in a way, this gave me some decent feedback. But so this was the first, and this maybe was in June of 2022, I think, yeah. So June 2022, I had this first demo and I didn't even have a Steam page at that point. So I kept working in the game, in the game and releasing updates to the demo. So I added relics. I put that in the demo.
Oh, so
I
added... maintained the demo and updated it over time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because my philosophy was the software philosophy of building things in the open. And I wanted to have a playable build at all times. And when I added a new concept, I would update. Ideally, so the theory there was, ideally, you say, I have this idea. And lots of people are, oh, that's a great idea. And then you let them play it, and they give you feedback, and you're making the game with them. You take the final decisions on everything, but you got lots of good ideas. Like, don't make bad chess pieces, make decent chess pieces, and then overpower chess pieces. And this is way more fun than playing with bad chess pieces. And you keep getting ideas like those. And so you make a great game because it's you working on the game, and then there's lots of good ideas from people. This is a great theory, but in practice, unless maybe you're someone famous, there's no one there to tell you things, to tell you make this, make that. So, but I kept updating it, and I kept adding new elements, and but still I made a bit of marketing efforts, putting it into Reddit. I also wrote about it on the TIG forums. But
TIG mean being?
I don't know if it's something about indie games. I don't know what's the, like,
the,
I think
the independent games
or maybe
TIG.
Yeah, TIG source forums. Like, I read somewhere that this was a good place to post your work, and I did have a handful of comments, but like nothing big, like nothing that would make your game commercially successful.
Okay.
And so I kept developing and updating the demo. And like there were some few instances where I got useful feedback, but not that many. And if you compare it to the amounts of good feedback that I got when streamers played my game, it's like in another league. I have an Excel file with suggestions that people put in a form that I had in the game. And there's like 400 lines there.
Okay.
And there's some people put there, you're an asshole, or this game is too difficult, I hate it. But there's lots of good suggestions and bug reports there.
Okay. So you made the demo, and then you kept working on the demo and updating it to be playable at all times. And then approaching the proper release, you sent the demo, which was after a lot of tweaks, to streamers, right?
Yep.
And some of them picked the demo up, and for the release.
When I sent the demo, the game was almost made. So.
Okay. Yeah, that's yeah. Well, okay. So that was the Ouroboros King release process. Yep. How would you make it for your next game? What changes?
So for my next game, I'm working on an auto battler, which will be announced maybe in a month or two. And I'll try to make a proper announcement for this one, and I'll try to contact press and see if someone wants to write up an article about this. So I'll keep some things secret. But for my next game, I want to have a demo with polished graphics, and that I think is a complete demo, not a demo that has to be updated. So the demo will be, and I'll try to have a demo that is maybe 40 or 1 hour minutes long, playable and also replayable. So in case someone wants to replay, I think that the Ouroboros King demo in its current state is replayable, but at the start there was not that much content.
Okay.
So yeah, I'll sort of try to get a definitive demo instead of an iterable demo, a definitive demo, and then release it, and in maybe in a fee after a couple of weeks contact streamers about my demo, and then when I'm closer to release, I'll probably send streamers the full game.
Okay.
So I'll try to do the same thing, release right after next fest, and so send streamers the full game, then have next fest and try to gather lots of wishlists, and then release and write that popularity search to try to get in popular upcoming.
Okay. I think I've read on your blog, which is, by the way, a great source of information for the project management and, generally speaking, what to expect from the launch of the game and how did it look like for your situation. So if anybody is interested in making their first game, I think it's a great source of information. You put a lot of data, just raw data, how it looked like, how it changed over time. It's really nice. I think I've read it that the negative reviews made it one of the most stressful days of your life, something like that.
Yeah.
What was that, and how would you change it for the next game?
Okay, so I had a couple of negative reviews that I perceived were very misguided. So there were some people saying that, like, I don't know if it was the game was too easy or too hard or something like this, and I was like, and so I'll first say why this is important. So you've put a lot, you've put a year of effort into this, and then you release it, and you will have a score that says mostly positive or mixed or whatever. And this is based on your reviews. And if you have just 10 reviews, having 2 bad reviews is a lot of bad reviews. It's 20%. And if you have 4 bad reviews out of the 10, you may get mixed. I don't know how Steam does it, but because I think that when you get more reviews, you can get a finer level of description. And I don't know if 4 versus 6 is mixed reviews, but I didn't want to get mixed reviews when I launched. And I had the Discord community that had grown thanks to the streamers of people that seemed to be enjoying my game, and then having a couple of bad reviews that I felt were a bit misguided. I don't really remember exactly what it was about. I think maybe some guy said that the AI doesn't see your items, and sometimes you can use items to easily cheese some levels. But the items cost a lot of money in the game. So in my view, it's relatively balanced. And if you play at higher difficulties, you're very strapped for cash, so you cannot abuse this. But so someone was like saying that this was not a good game because some reason that I felt was not very... So you can critique my game, but, or I had some comment at some point saying that this is a bad deal if you compare it to Isaac or Terraria. And I'm like, okay, but you can play Isaac so many hours after that. Like, I think I made a decent game, and I would even say a good game, but I have not made a genre defining game. I'm aware of that.
I think I was more getting at how I think you can't escape negative reviews and people not liking your game. Like, even if it's like a magnificent game, you will get the negative reviews. And what do you think you can do to avoid it being so impactful on, like, you know, you're working for a full year, you're dedicating a massive amount of time and effort, and like everything goes into making this game, and then you're so hopeful, and then you're more vulnerable, and when you see the negative reviews. So yeah. do you have like a different strategy for the next game, how to handle this day when you release and then you'll see somebody like, I would do it differently? No.
Yeah, I don't know. So being more experienced and having gone through it at least once will surely make it less stressful. Another thing that happened was that since I got so much feedback right after releasing, so I think I released about 2 weeks after NextFest, and during NextFest was when I got a lot of attention, and so lots of people coming into my Discord server, lots of people talking about the game and giving me suggestions, and I wanted to improve the game and add some suggestions. So even though the release was very close, I kept adding content until the day before the release. I was adding content there. This time I will try to not and adding content, maybe adding some bugs. So this time I'll try to, one, like, close the game you're going to release maybe a week or two before launch, and being like, okay, that's what I release. I may do a patch a week after release or 2 days after release if there's something big that needs to be changed, but this is the game that I'm going to be releasing. And it was like not I was not adding lots of, I did add some quality of life changes, but I also added maybe maybe I doubled the amount of relics in the game in the week before release, because I got so many good ideas. And I was also seeing that your game is getting attention, gives you lots of energy to work. So not being stressed for working so much, knowing that even if that happens, you may still, the game can still succeed. So it's not the end of the world if you get a couple of bad reviews that you think are quite misguided. And then another thing that I did for the Ouroboros King is that I gave lots of free keys to my most important players. Oh, okay. So in the community. So I had people testing my game. So I think it, like, they deserved them. They tested the game for free for me. They had a fun time. But also, if you give free keys to your biggest supporters, they're not giving you reviews. So these reviews don't count toward your rating. Because because you gave them the keys.
Yes.
So if you don't do that, they will leave reviews for you that will be good. And if you give them keys, those reviews don't count or have an asterisk like this was from a given key.
Yeah.
So it's... maybe not doing this can also skew your reviews positively. Yeah. And giving these keys skews it badly. I have mixed feelings about it because so people that have helped you deserve to be rewarded, but
yeah,
Steam sort of penalizes you for that.
It's like you can give them free keys, but ideally they would not use them. They would just give those keys to their friends.
That would be great.
But it's not how it works, I guess. Can you do you have any other project management tips before we move into more game design world? Or did we cover? Did we cover everything?
I think we covered most things. If you want a book recommendation, I read The Checklist Manifesto.
Okay.
Which it's written by a doctor. And I think really in general, project management tips are usually like common sense. You just don't have to get over your head. And this book is from a doctor. And he's saying things like, just make a checklist of the things you have to do and tick them all. And this helped reduce infections in hospitals by a lot, because sometimes a doctor will make an operation and will leave some tissue or something inside the patient. And if you have a checklist that says, we have used 5 tissues, do you have them in hand? Ah, yes. Oh, no, there's one still inside the patient. Okay, take that out. Or things like, make sure that everyone says their name and state which procedure you're going to make, because sometimes it has happened, and this has happened, someone gets an operation that they didn't need, that they were scheduled for some other operation, and there's some confusion. And just having this checklist, which is like, this is not rocket science, this is something very simple. Yeah. Just having this checklist avoids major disasters. So, and it's, so yeah, what do I need to make to complete this project? A, B, C, D. And if there's some things that you don't know, if you can make, try to validate first if you will make it. Also, the other thing I wanted to say is, because sometimes I see these discussions on Reddit of doing your dream game that you're passionate about and that you really want to do versus doing a game that you think you can do, but maybe you feel it's kind of shitty and you're not so passionate about. And what I would say here is, okay, get your dream game, break it down into pieces. If you want to make, a Souls-like game, this is like the obvious type of game that everyone thinks is great. But when you're starting, you clearly don't have the capabilities of doing. So maybe first make a game that is one smallish map, or make a roguelike that uses some of the mechanics that you want to use. Roguelikes are very good for starting developers because you can make some content, and then if you build an algorithm that reshuffles that content, you have like sort of infinite content without having to do so much. So make a roguelike that uses some of those elements, and then make another game that makes some of the other elements that you want to include in your final game that weren't in your first. And then maybe you have all the hard skills, or not hard skills, you have all the technical skills, but you don't have the artistic skills. So then try to take one of your games or one scene from your games and try to make that as beautiful as possible. So, and make steps to build it. And this is, if you want to make a Souls-like in your own, it may take 3 years or whatever, but do it step by step. Don't say, oh, I won't be finished until the full game is over. You have to like get smaller victories and maybe something that can support you financially if this is what you're interested in also.
Yeah, that's a great tips for project management and for making games, I think. Starting small, scoping down, and it's also, yeah, a lot of people want to start by doing the dream game, which is obviously too big. And that's a really interesting take to extract things that interest you from this game and make them into a smaller version of this game, just yep. a small version. So you get both the dream aspect and the scoped down version of the project.
Okay. Yeah, also, game development is very multidisciplinary and there's lots of aspects to it. And you have to try to understand what goes into each of them. So in my first game, this may tie into how to get into game development, but my first game was a tutorial that I just followed the tutorial and this is what I got about how to make a platformer in Unity. My second game was me trying to hand make all the assets for a platformer that was similar to the first and maybe had a couple of different things. So I drew the sprites and I made some sound effects that were like, it's a bit embarrassing, but I also think it's funny. I think the video is on my YouTube channel and when the guy is walking, I'm like there, tap, 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 tap. So, yeah. And so it's everything is a bit like this, but this lets you know how hard that is. And so you spend 2 hours making sound effects. They hear very bad. And you feel, okay, so if 2 hours of me doing this is this bad, like me doing everything from scratch, it's so much time and I'll have to cut somewhere. And after doing this, I made another game that was just a platformer with magnets with no graphics. So there I was working on level design and you start acquiring skills and start to know, okay, this part takes that much time. Talking about scoping, the Ouroboros King, I think, was a great sort of first commercial game because it almost required no graphics. So unless you're an artist,
yeah,
or either do a game that requires little to no graphics, or use assets. But be mindful about that. If you want to code the game, put everything into Unity or whatever engine you're using, and organize the scenes and also make the art, this project is going to take a lot of time. So try to pick your fights, pick yeah. your battles and focus on one thing at a time.
Okay. Yeah, that's true. That's true. Okay. Can you tell me more about the design of the Ouroboros King? You mentioned fairy chess, which I'm not familiar as a concept, like in general. So you're saying that there is a world of people that develop more and more things onto the chess as a game. So more pieces, more mechanics, more different kind of things. So is this the inspiration you got? This is where you went for the inspiration, or this is where you wanted to...
So I did surely go into that world. Most of the things in fairy chess are different movesets. So you have, for instance, in chess, you have the knight that moves like an L, 2-1-1. And then in fairy chess, there's, I don't remember the names, but the giraffe that moves 3-1. And then there's the camel that moves like 4-1. So there's lots of weird patterns like that. I tried those in my game and they were so unintuitive that I had to take them out because when I was playing against the AI, it would kill me all the time with these pieces because they were not in my brain. And I felt like if this happens to me that I'm working on this game, like new people will have tons of trouble with them. So, but there's also there's also other pieces that I did. For instance, there's the Manticore that can move one and then one upwards and then diagonally and then one to the side and then diagonally. And this piece I took straight from, I think, okay, the Manticore, I think, is what it's called in my game. And I don't know if in Fairy Chess it has a different name, but I took that idea and got it and yanked it into the Ouroboros King. And yeah, I don't know if this is a more modern thing or a more, let's say, ancient. So I don't know if people did fairy chess in the 18th century or whatever. But there's a Wikipedia page with this, and I scanned it all. And there's also some. This is not something very popular, I think, but there's this Wikipedia page that is well maintained. And then there's some more obscure blogs with other ideas, and I did. Of course, look for inspiration there. I think that when you're making a game, if someone has worked into something similar, it's always good to see what they've done for two reasons. First, so that you don't make the same thing that someone else did, even if it's by accident. And second, so that you can take the best ideas and maybe some of them are useful to you.
For me, one of the most innovative part was the boulders blocking chess moves. Like, is on one hand it's such a obvious thing, but it adds so much complexity, like, to all of the pieces that you've usually used for playing chess. Now all of a sudden you can't move there because there's a boulder, even though in the other world where you had like a full normal chessboard you would be able to. Is these also are part of fairy chess, or this is more?
No, I don't think so. I think this maybe came from maybe tactics games like Final Fantasy Tactics. And this is something that in Final Fantasy Tactics, there's, for people that, I don't know if I have to explain for people that don't know, but basically it's a turn-based game where you have an army in a grid style map, and during your turn you can move all of your pieces, and then you can cast abilities and so on, but there's always boulders, and then I think there's always other hazards, like maybe there's water on the floor, and then you move slower in the water, and maybe there's some walls that obstruct your vision. So I wanted to add some terrain to the game to make the map, and this ties into the roguelike idea of design where you make it so the game is not always the same. So I wanted to have the chessboard, but I wanted it to be different every time. So I added boulders. And then in the second and third maps or the second and third acts of the game, there's other hazards, which are a bit more complicated even than the boulders.
Yeah. But so let's maybe list categories of extensions that you've built on top of chess. I think the chessboard manipulations in terms of the hazards and boulders, it's one thing. Then there's relics, so you have the items that you can use during the game, right?
So there's relics, which are global bonuses that affect all of your pieces, unless otherwise stated by the relic. And then there's items that are one-use objects that give you... you can have an enemy not move for one turn, or you can have one of your pieces move like a bishop, even if it's not a bishop, for one turn.
Yeah. You also have time-related abilities, right? Because you add ability to rewind time, like move back your moves so that you can replay the fatal mistakes you've done. And there is this one thing that you mentioned about the killing the king. You made like an optimization of not doing like a checkmate and it's gone. It's actually your king sprangs to kill the other king. And also, yeah. I think it's brilliant. There is this annoying part of chess where you know that it's pretty much done, but you still need to execute like 15 moves or whatever to actually block the king for the secure time. And I think you do this optimization, right? Where you fast forward to the ending.
Okay. About this. So there's some checkmates in chess that are very easy, So if you have to make with two rooks and the enemy has no pieces but their king, that's very easy and almost everyone can do that. But if you have to mate with two bishops, I think it can be done. But I'm not sure if I had a time pressure, I could do that. And if I had to do that in the Ouroboros king, it could maybe take me 5 minutes of chasing the enemy king around until I get it right. So these are some things that, from a spectator, it's very obvious that you have won, or sort of obvious. And even, but from the game, but by the rules, it's not obvious. You have to do it, and it's annoying. And so that this is why I added this finisher relic, that if you have some pieces and the enemy doesn't, apart from their king, you instantly win. To avoid the tedium of chasing the enemy king around the board, because it's a bit annoying. And also, if you some pieces cannot mate, if you have just a bishop and a king, you, unless the opponent blunders, you cannot win in regular chess. And maybe, I'm not sure, you'd have to check, but maybe even if the opponent blunders, it may be a possibility that you cannot mate them.
Okay. Yeah.
That maybe the best that you can get is a stalemate. And also, I thought that the stalemate thing in chess was a bit of, was bullshit. That if I have if I have you cornered, I mean stalemate when the enemy has no moves. If I have you cornered,
yeah,
and then it just and you have no moves. For to me, this shouldn't be a stalemate. This should be a win. I think for the game of chess, played at the highest level, where so many games end in draws and whatever, this may be a cool feature. And for chess purists, they will probably love their stalemates. And there are some chess puzzles that revolve around from a losing position getting into a stalemate.
Yeah, but so, like, yeah, there is a pretty much chess for everyday people and chess for pros. There are two different games, right?
Even though they exactly. have
the same think, rules, it's like it's a different world. So.
So I think that if you're playing a game with your friend and neither of you is going to chess school or reading chess books, these things don't make a lot of sense, so I removed them. And regarding what you said about moving time and rewinding your moves, something that is very common in chess is that you make the move, and the moment you make the move, you realize you blundered something, and the AI takes your queen, and you're like, oh, that was a bad move. So to me, this rewind thing is sort of the life mechanic, your health mechanic for this game. And so you're allowed to make, I think you start with 10 rewinds in the base game, and then you can make the game harder by reducing this number. But you're allowed 10 blunders. And sometimes blunders you realize in two moves, and that will cost you two health. But in this way, but you're allowed 10 blunders, and after that you're on your own and you cannot make more blunders. There's mechanics to get more health back. But yeah.
Yeah. And what other innovations are there in chess? You can upgrade your pieces. By the way, you don't start with full set of chess pieces. You have just a few of them, I think three. And then you can add more, and then you can upgrade them. And there's all sorts of wacky upgrades, for example, right? Like new pieces that if you kill the other piece, it transforms and things like that.
Yep. So regarding not having the full army there, I think that I've played a lot of chess and I don't particularly like the openings that you have to remember what to do in each situation. If I do this, my opponent can do one of these three things that make sense. Other moves may be bad, but one of these three things, and I have to memorize the whole tree of options for the beginning, and just try to have a good memory and play lots of situations very similar ones to get the optimal reaction. And I don't really like that. I enjoy more the tactics. There's a bit of more of an open field. There's not that many pawns in there, and then try to outmaneuver with fast moves, that not with taking 20 moves because the pawns just move once. So moving with three or four moves, win fast and or get a very good situation fast. And this is what I was looking for. So I wouldn't say that the game really resembles regular chess, but I would say more that it resembles chess tactics, where chess tactics is situations that are either taken from a game or sometimes handcrafted with a handful of pieces or two or maybe 10 pieces, and where you have to find good combinations to get the advantage.
Okay.
And regarding like new pieces, yeah, I tried to make, so bring everything that I like from gaming into chess and make, I tried to find mechanics that are elegant and that don't require a lot of explanation, and also that make sense for the game and that are fun. And so there's pieces that explode when they get taken. There's pieces that get upgraded after killing an enemy. There's pieces that debuff the enemy that killed them. There's pieces with very weird move patterns. There's the catapult that can jump over pieces. So there's, yeah, lots of different mechanics that I think that add more depth to the game, and that make it, in my opinion, more fun. That give you more options. That you're not always playing with a very small set of pieces. That they give you more options. And what I really like about this is that some of these pieces allow for combos that can give a very big effect. One of my favorite is you have this Phoenix, or there's two. There's like Fire Chick, and then that then evolves into Phoenix. That those are pieces that when they die, they respawn at next, like at where they started, more or less. And so, but they have very limited move sets. They move like one or two squares at a time. And then you have the Bannerman that allows all of the pieces that are next to it to move like a queen. While they will just have one queen move, because then they will move and they won't be next to it. So the idea here is that you place your Phoenix next to the Bannerman, and then you snipe some of the enemy piece, and then the enemy will capture it, and then the Phoenix will respawn at the same place, and then you can go again. So you sort of have an infinite queen army that can keep trading and then respawning. So this is one of my favorite combos from the game, and seeing that, and I didn't plan for this sort of appeared. So adding new pieces has this advantage that you can win, as I said before, by outmaneuvering your opponents, but you can also try to win by assembling a sort of unbeatable combo and winning through that.
Okay. I like your touch of adding names to pieces, and to have a king with a name, and now you're commanding an army. It's like, I never looked at chess as an army that I'm commanding, more like a game, right? It's like, no, it's a game. And then with these names, it changes all the how I view these, and then you keep adding more pieces and upgrading them, and then it's like more contextual, historical, and now you have this all new concept of adding just stemming from the name. You add more context to it. Was this a random decision, or you had this planned somehow?
So I wanted to make a story for the game, and there's some roguelikes that don't have a story. Like for Slay the Spire, there's some lore, but from playing the game, you don't really. Maybe there's like a video somewhere in the internet with all the lore that I missed. But from playing the game, it's like, okay, you're some random dude that is going through a castle or whatever that is killing people in their way. But you don't. Why are you doing this? And I don't know. But then there's other games like Hades, for instance, that is also a roguelike that has a very deep story. I really enjoyed Hades, but I'm not a story guy, and I wasn't really feeling capable of making a great story. And I was thinking that maybe I wouldn't have a story for my game. But at some point, I read a comment that someone said that all these details that are in games are sometimes what makes people love them. So I decided to make something, and I came up with this story about some kingdom. So it's a very classic story of kingdom in danger, and then the prince or the king has to rescue the kingdom. with this idea that tied with the idea of the Ouroboros, which is sort of the god of the of this place that allows the king to go back in time if he fails in his mission. And this ties with the idea of a roguelike. So it worked well, but I'm no expert in these sorts of things. I wanted to have some lore to the game and not be, this is a game, just mechanics. Because I think it's not so much about people making a very deep story, but about giving a context in which this is happening. And then the player's imagination can do lots of things for you that you don't have to explicitly do. And so if you place your game in a context and it's somewhat decently done, players will fill in the blanks, and sometimes even not that it has happened, or at least that I know of, but sometimes they will even make a fan art and invent stories for side characters and everything. So you just place everything in a context and have players fill the gaps. And no, so this story that you told me about that you felt like giving the player a name, the main character a name, and it's not just the king, it's Octavius, king of Thessalonia. So I didn't think about it this way, but I'm very happy that I put it into the game. If it made you feel the game differently and gave you more context and gave you and made it more enjoyable to you.
Yeah. Can you tell me more about the UI and the design of the UI? I think it's a split screen, pretty much in half, right? And yep. You always have the chessboard when you're playing. Obviously, the encounter, the battle, you have a chessboard on the left, and then you have the notes on the right. If you're in the map, you have the map on the left and the notes on the right. I think it's quite brilliant that you always have the clear space for telling the player what he or she looks at. Like, you always have this right part where you can always say, oh, you're hovering over this thing does this, and it can be used in this way.
Okay. So one of my key philosophies is, if someone did it and it works, don't try to reinvent it. All that from this game called Pondbarian. That is another
Pondbarian.
Chess. Yeah, okay. That is another chess roguelike that plays. It's a chess roguelike that you play with cards, and cards are, you can move now like a pawn, or you can move now like a rook. It's a very fun game. You should try it. The creator also was super friendly, and he bundled with me when I launched. So shout out to Jan. And so in that game, it's a bit, the UI is a bit different. You have the cards in your deck on the left, and then at the center there's the chessboard, and then at the right is this description of whatever you're hovering over. And I saw that and I thought, okay, this looks very clean and this looks like something I can do. There is no super ornate background that someone has to draw. It looked clean and it looked good, and I said, okay, I'll try to replicate this. For my game, it didn't make sense to have the board on the center and then things at both sides. So I tried to do that and think about what can I put on the other side, but it didn't make sense. So in the end, I just moved the board to the left and had this split screen that I think works well, looks clean, and gives you all the information. And there's plenty of space on the right. I also added this thing where, for some pieces with weird movement patterns, there's a board. When you hover over the piece, there's a miniature board that shows you what the piece moves like. And I think this is also very, having this space is also good to add these other elements that make it easier to see. And I took this from Pondbarian, and I also sort of took from Slay the Spire the fact that on top and at the bottom you have, I think, you have some UI elements like what level you're in and so on. And at the bottom, you have the relics and the items. And I sort of copied that from Slay the Spire. I think in games, if you're making a game from a new genre, maybe you have to invent something. But there's some conventions, and players will expect you to follow those conventions. So it's very good to look at what other games have done. And if you're having trouble solving a problem, a UI problem, or even a game design problem, try to look at games from the same genre and see how they solved it and see if that fits you. Maybe you have to take that and give it a couple spins, but generally,
yeah,
unless it's very specific to your game, there will be other solutions to that problem that you can take inspiration from.
Fighting with conventions may backfire a lot.
Yeah, also, I think I agree with that. In my case, I've had some people saying that chess is a classic, chess is perfect, don't mess with it.
But Baldur's Gate 3 had their whole UI, all the thing that you see in the scene while making, like, the, you know, it's an RPG, you have a lot of, you have a minimap, you have abilities, you have a lot of information to convey, and they had all the UI reworked in the early access. The first thing that they came up with was not digestible to players, and over a couple of years of their early access, they reworked this entirely to fit the players' expectations. So that's also, like, you know, an example from larger scope game trying to a little bit mess with the expectations. Okay, I want to give a shout out to the full piece. Fool, do you know? The one that steals or will have the capability. Have the capability of it will be using the same movements set that you have used in your turn. So depending on which kind of chess piece you're selecting, the fool from your, let's say, enemy can copy this move. This made me such a headache, and I was like trying to get all the possibilities from what can I do so that the fool will not just wreck me entirely. It's such a cool mind game mechanics. Like, I playing Ouroboros King, I had so many moments where I was like, this is so much better than the ordinary chess. Like, this is so cool. Like, to take this and invent. So
I think this piece is from Fairy Chess. I think I did that one. But yeah, it's a really cool piece. I have to say, I didn't use it much in my art. So when I saw the fool, I almost never picked it. But some of the people in my Discord that play way better than me told me that this is one of the best pieces and that you can use it. So if you put it in front, if you manage to get that in front of the enemy king, then the enemy cannot move their pieces that can move like rooks, because then you would capture them instantly. And so it is hard to use, but can be very, very effective in forcing the enemy from not doing certain things. And obviously, when you're faced against it, you have to be extra careful.
Yeah. How does it feel to play your own game worse than your following, than your people in Discord?
Well, this is always going to happen, and if you're making a chess game, there's this guy. I think it's okay. There's a guy called Astral. Yeah. This is his Discord nickname, and that he was maybe 2300 Elo player. So it was obvious from the start that this guy was going to play this game better than me, and it's great to have people that play your game better than you, so you can have better feedback and some things that you were not sure how to do. These top players from your game can give you better balance ideas that maybe you would have. Okay. At least to balance the game at the top level. I think a game should be balanced for newcomers, but also for experienced players. But if you cannot get to that level, having this type of feedback is very useful and is great. And I have, like, maybe someone would have an ego about this, but no, like, not in my case.
And you mentioned before that there were some issues when we were talking about the project management. You were mentioning that you needed to come back to your design for the chess pieces and their movements. You were mentioning that you started laying them out in the Excel file and then changing them. So how did you technically handle the, in the okay. end, How did it handle the movements?
But you want to talk about the design philosophy or about the technicalities?
Imagine that we have, I'm not sure how many different pieces are there.
There's
in your
about
game.
55 or 57, I think.
Yeah, so you have to, in some way, transfer the information to the engine and make it work. So how did you do it technically?
Okay, so it's basically for there's like two main there's pieces that move like in lines,
yeah,
in straight lines, and then there's pieces that do weird stuff. So the pieces that move in straight lines, there's an Excel file that says you move in this direction and you can move up to n times. So for instance, a rook is a piece that can move one up and can move up to 16 times, because there's portals in the game, and if you enter a portal that's at the end and then it has to come up, it has to be able to move, I don't know if it's 16 or maybe 14 times. So the rook is move up to 16 times, move left up to 16 times, move right up to 16 times, and move down up to 16 times. And there's an Excel file where I put this. And so whenever I have to change something like this, I just edit it in the Excel file. Then there's other pieces like the portal or the fool that you just commented that moves like the last piece that moved, and that is obviously in the code that you just have to look at what piece moved last and then copy its moveset. Or there's the portal mage that can move anywhere in the map but can only kill or capture pieces that are adjacent to it. So then the adjacent to it can be coded via the Excel file that any place on the map is with a custom function that just works for that piece. But having this, so it's a lot easier to modify things in an Excel file than having to go to the code. So if there's some in your game, if there's something that repeats a lot of times, it's good to have it parameterized so that with your data, so just editing an Excel file, you can change everything. For my next game, that is an auto battler, that is also a card game. It's similar to Hearthstone's Battlegrounds mode. I've made a system that will, where the cards are coded via an Excel file also, and that you say, okay, this card will target this kind of cards, will have this kind of effects with this amount of value. So deal damage, and then the value is how much damage. And so I will write a blog post about this. It's halfway written, and I will also. So you talked about my blog before. I will be adding some new posts in the following months about some marketing tips from my game, the efficiency of all the things that I've done, and also how I implemented how I did the made card abilities for my game. And most of the abilities are just there's code to handle things, but all my cards are just one line in a spreadsheet, which is great because it makes it so much easier to iterate and to make changes.
You should mention how people can
find your blog. It's just my name .com, so uriolcosp.com.
Yeah. And from your blog, I think, you mentioned that at some point near the end of the project, you ignored the code quality and it was a bad idea. Can you tell me more about this?
Well, yeah, there's always trade-offs between going fast and writing good code that you will understand or that will be easier to modify the next time. And so I was feeling a bit of pressure and I was feeling like I had to go faster. And I said, okay, no more refactors until we end this. And
when was it?
Maybe when there were like 3 or 4 months left, I was like, okay, I wanted to finish this game in a year. Let's stop doing refactors, even if I feel like it, and just focus on delivering. And so at the end, I was like, I want to finish this project so bad because it's a mess, and I want to stop having. I think this is sort of inevitable when the code base grows, but and so many ideas that you didn't have at the start. I also was a Unity and C# novice when I started working on this, so there's lots of things that I do differently now, and this sort of mistakes or irregularities keep piling on top of each other. And at the end, you have code that is harder to understand and to work with than it should be. So, and I regretted it because at some time this caused some bugs that I wouldn't have missed if the code was more clear. And also fixing some other bugs was slower than it should be if the code was cleaner.
Okay. I think during this talk you've made quite a lot of good advice and gave a lot of good advice for especially starting new projects and new game developers, aspiring game developers. We'll probably be closing this conversation. Do you have anything like closing thoughts on the either advice front or
No, for me, the biggest advice is try to do something that you can do. Yeah. And if you're new to game to making games, start with small steps, small projects, and build up from there. And just common sense. Don't try to go for the moon, because it's very easy to think, oh, I'd love to make that game, but you should be pretty confident that you know how hard it is before you start doing the project to make the game.
Okay. And where people can follow your work?
So I'd say I have a Twitter account that I don't use much, but I have this blog, and you can subscribe to it. I will be posting every time I update the blog. I will be posting it to Twitter, and I have a Discord server, and you can join it.
What's the name?
The name of the Discord server? I don't know, but it's on the. It's probably Uriel Cosp Games. It's probably on the Steam page of the Ouroboros King.
Okay.
And if you want, I can send you an invite code or whatever. But
we'll put all the links in the description for this.
So I'll
video.
send you the Discord invite.
Yeah.
In case there's more details about my upcoming project, but I have to sort of keep it secret, so I can do a proper announcement when I have the Steam page ready and everything.
Okay. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Thanks a lot, Lucas, for having me.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.